everybody. It's Dr. Amy Myers with the Myers Way Podcast. Today, I have a great guest with a very hot topic that I know many of you all are going to enjoy. I have Isabella Wentz here, who is the author of Hashimoto's Thyroiditis, you can tell us the real, there are quite a number of titles here, Lifestyle Interventions for Finding and Treating the Root Cause. So welcome, Isabella.
Thank you so much, Dr. Amy. I'm really excited to be on with you and share some information about Hashimoto's with everybody.
Great. Well, first, tell us your background. You're a pharmacist, so I mean, I should probably be addressing you as Dr. Wentz as well, but I like to be informal here, so we'll go with Isabella and Amy.
That works for me, too.
So tell us about your background.
So I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's in 2009, and prior to that, I had already been a practicing pharmacist. I got my PharmD, Doctor of Pharmacy degree in 2006 from Midwestern University College of Pharmacy. And I went on to be trained in medication therapy management as well as advanced certifications in medication management, diabetes management, and worked as a consultant pharmacist doing case reviews for really, really complicated people with rare disorders. So eventually that came in really, really handy because I was able to use a lot of my research skills on myself and trying to get to the root cause of my own thyroid condition.
Yeah, it's really helpful sometimes, helpful and harmful sometimes when you have those backgrounds, you know, in medicine, like, you know, knowing enough, but, you know, kind of sometimes knowing too much. I don't know if you experienced that as you were going through your, you know, health issues.
You know, I very much experienced that. And a lot of it was, you know, we're just trained to be so skeptical that I was really, really skeptical and sometimes got in my own way of getting better. So one particular thing was the whole adrenal fatigue thing. So I, you know, Mayo Clinic says it doesn't exist, so therefore it can't, right?
Yeah, right. Well, so tell us about your diagnosis and then your journey to getting well and what you uncovered on your journey.
So Hashimoto's is a really, really personal condition for me. So I had IBS for 7 to 8 years before I was diagnosed. And I also had really, really debilitating fatigue. So I was sleeping 12 to 13 hours a night. And, you know, being a pharmacy student, that wasn't the easiest thing. So I basically went to class, slept, studied, ate, and slept some more. Somehow I managed to get by, but it just was a constant health struggle for me that started in my early 20s. And eventually I went on to develop many more symptoms, including allergies, anxiety, acid reflux, hair loss, brain fog. And, you know, I lived in Southern California and I was sleeping with two blankets and I was cold all the time and it was beautiful outside. It was 70 degrees and I was just freezing. So eventually I was diagnosed with Hashimoto's in 2009. And at first I was just so relieved to finally have a diagnosis. I was like, thank you. Thank you. You know, this is it. I know what to do now. I'm just going to take medications and everything will get better. And unfortunately that didn't happen. So I, you know, some of my symptoms got better. Instead of sleeping 12 to 13 hours, I was sleeping, you know, 11. I was able to get rid of my extra blanket, but I still had all these gut issues and I still had my allergies and anxiety. And I just, you know, I thought I was really doing everything right. I was eating according to the food pyramid. I was exercising 3 times a week. I wasn't smoking. And, you know, I really, in pharmacy school, we always stressed lifestyle changes. So for a lot of the chronic diseases like diabetes and hypertension, we were always told, okay, make sure you let this person know that there are medications that absolutely help, but also that they really need to focus on their lifestyle. And I kind of thought, you know, well, what did I do in my life that got me to develop this condition? And what can I do to maybe halt its progression or stop it? Or is there anything that could be done to prevent it? And I really was scared because, you know, as we know, having one autoimmune condition puts us at a greater risk of having another one. So I wanted to do everything in my power to prevent that.
Yes. And, you know, I don't know how many people do know that. I'm actually writing an article and a book about autoimmune right now, and I have that statement in there. You're actually three times more at risk of getting another autoimmune disease. And so, you know, something like Hashimoto's, I mean, not that it's fun that you went through that, and we'll continue to hear your story of how you've, you know, recovered from that. But, you know, that's pretty manageable with medicine for most people once you sort of fix all the other things. But, you know, there are other ones that are not really fun to have, like, you know, scleroderma or lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, that, of course, using a functional medicine approach, we can definitely help people with all of those, but not ones that are just, you know, just super easily treated by a, you know, a pill.
Exactly. And my mom is a medical doctor, and she was saying, you know, if I had to pick an autoimmune disease, it would be Hashimoto's, because it's one where you can address most easily. But I think it's also a wake-up call for people to say, hey, I've got this thing, and I, you know, it could be a lot worse, and I have to, you know, really start working on my health. My body's trying to tell me something.
And something else that I found interesting that you said is that how in pharmacy school that they're really teaching you about the lifestyle changes. And, you know, I mean, you could answer this better, but I mean, I've certainly, and maybe it's because I'm a physician, I've rarely ever had a conversation with my pharmacist, right? I mean, you just kind of, if you go to get a medication, it's like, you know, do you need to talk to them about the side effects or how to take it? And then nobody's sitting there that I'm aware of, but I've of course never been on hypertension or high cholesterol meds, saying, hey, let's sit down and have a conversation about, you know, lifestyle changes. And it's also kind of ironic that it's after you've just met with the physician and they've written the prescription that then they're leaving it in the pharmacist's hands to talk about the lifestyle changes.
You know, and I think it's sort of, it's everybody should be doing it, but nobody has the time. And I think as a healthcare community, as a healthcare system, we really need to get better at that, because, you know, the pharmacist is oftentimes busy filling 500 prescriptions and their staff technicians called in sick, and they, you know, they really should be addressing those lifestyle things, but, you know, they just don't have the time.
Well, I mean, it's great that you even got some training in it, right? I mean, in medical school, we really don't get any training in that. I mean, it's not, it may be things are different now from when I went through, but it certainly was not very much about, you know, when someone came in with diabetes or hypertension, it's like, you know, you need to lose weight or you need to exercise. And that was sort of the extent, but it wasn't about, well, how really does somebody do that? Not to mention the whole food pyramid and how, you know, many doctors would be recommending, you know, whole grains or low fat or something that wouldn't be really consistent with health anyway.
Right. Yeah. We just, I think we get most of, I joke that we get most of our nutrition education from commercials.
Right. So on your lab test, I mean, you actually sound like you're one of the lucky ones where, you know, you felt bad and you actually went to the doctor and got diagnosed. I mean, the story that I hear repeatedly is I go and they have a lot of the symptoms that you have, but, you know, they do sort of the standard blood test for thyroid and nothing shows up. So you actually sound like you were kind of a lucky one that maybe something did show up and you weren't bouncing around to multiple doctors kind of just telling you you're nuts and here's some antidepressants.
You know, I actually went through that as well. So I did have a lot of offers for antidepressants. Wow. So, and you know, one of my things was, well, I'm not depressed. I'm just really tired and my hair is falling out and I feel kind of anxious and this is new for me. And they, you know, one answer I got was you're getting older, and I was 25. So thank you.
Wow. That's incredible.
Yeah. Another thing is, you know, you're depressed or you know, everybody's under stress. And so, yeah, I think I had the advantage of being a pharmacist that I kind of was like, okay, well, I don't have to go to this doctor. I can go to another doctor. And I asked, I asked around who the best doctors were in town. And that's how I was able to find somebody that would actually do more of comprehensive testing. But yeah, it's absolutely very difficult for patients to get diagnosed. And a lot of times they will get the people looking at them like they are crazy, like they're, you know, you're a hypochondriac. What's wrong with you?
Right. Well, so let's continue with your story, because, I mean, ultimately it ended up leading into this great, you know, book. I actually had a patient come into my office carrying your book saying, circling everything and underlining it. And have we checked for this? Have we checked for that? I'm like, yep, we've checked for that. Yep, we've checked for that. But it was really great that she was, you know, even, yeah, I mean, you know, taking things even more into her own hands and coming in, you know, having read your book. So you have a lot of great information. So tell us, you know, what happened? You started on thyroid medicine and what happened for you? And then how did that sort of culminate into this great resource book?
So I just really decided to do my own research. Like I said, I was working as a consultant pharmacist, and I used to do case reviews and whole person assessments for people with really complicated cases and rare genetic disorders and disabilities and mental health issues. And so I came across somebody with celiac disease. And for every case review that I did, I really researched every single one of their conditions to see what kind of implications their medications or anything else that they were going through might have. So when I researched celiac disease, I found a connection with Hashimoto's. And I also found a PubMed article where they talked about people who followed a gluten-free diet with celiac disease were able to reverse their Hashimoto's. So their antibodies to the thyroid went away, as well as they no longer needed medications and their thyroid function normalized. And I thought, you know, this was so exciting for me. And I was like, this is great. And I actually saw my endocrinologist, who was very, very kind man, but at the same time, I printed off a study for him, and he said, "You want me to read this whole thing?" He's like, "Oh, you just have to wait until there's nothing you can do. Just take these pills, wait until your thyroid burns out, then we'll give you more medications and we'll monitor you for additional autoimmune conditions." And you know, and I just, that approach just made me feel really helpless. So I thought, you know, I want to take charge of my own health. And at that point, I had this mystery cough for 3 years, where I had to sleep upright for almost 3 years. I had IBS for almost a decade, and my stomach was so distended that people often ask me if I was pregnant. So I tested for celiac disease. I was negative, but I just, you know, I kept thinking, you know, all of this has to be connected somehow. This just, you know, the thyroid doesn't live in a vacuum, and if people with celiac have these gut issues and I have these gut issues, you know, what's the connection here? So I actually saw a functional medicine doctor. So really, really appreciate the work that you do.
Awesome.
And she ran a food sensitivity panel on me and found that I was sensitive to gluten and dairy. So had a whole bunch of other things, but those were the two main things that I had. So I'll tell you what, within 3 days of going gluten-free and dairy-free, this mystery cough that had me, you know, waking up in the middle of the night, had me running out of meetings, coughing, having coughing fits, that was completely gone in 3 days. I had been on taking bottles of Maalox, Tums, and Pepcid. All of that was history. So that was the beginning of my journey with functional medicine, and I've never turned back since. And that was almost exactly 3 years ago.
Great. That's awesome. Yeah, I've seen a lot of, I've had two patients with just these chronic unexplained coughs, you know, completely resolved just like yours did in the same kind of manner on, you know, all kinds of, you know, inhalants and allergy meds and, I mean, just the works. And, you know, it's as simple as the diet, as many of the listeners already know.
Yeah, I was a walking pharmacy and I was like, wow, this is... this is great. I just have to change my diet a little bit. And it was tough to change the diet because primarily the standard American diet, and I'm from Poland, so our diet is also very much focused on wheat and dairy. But, you know, once you know that these things are really harming you and you feel so much better off of them, it really wasn't an issue for me to be off of them.
Yeah, I have a colleague who a former colleague that I've been seeing for thyroid issues. And, you know, I mean, just as you know, probably being in the pharmacy, it's long hours, just like it is in medicine. And people are always bringing stuff and it's, you know, pizza late night, you're on call or you're working a late shift. And, you know, I was always the odd person in the ER showing up with my broccoli. And at the time I was a vegetarian. So I had tofu and brown rice and everybody else is eating McDonald's and stuff like that. And anyway, this patient, I could just tell when she came to see me, it was very, very overwhelming about the changes. And so, you know, whenever somebody's feeling that overwhelmed, I'm always saying, at least just start with the gluten or gluten in dairy. You know, I mean, if you can go all the way of getting out all the grains, that's awesome. But if you can really only start with gluten or gluten in dairy, that's the place to start. That's going to give you the most bang for your buck. And so anyway, she did, feeling great, you know, had a couple slips and immediately noticed it and was like, yeah, it's just so not worth it. And I said, yeah, I was out at dinner with some friends the other night and they had ordered some sort of dessert to share. And I don't remember, I honestly don't even remember what it was. I just knew it was something that I was not going to eat. It involved gluten and dairy. So, and one of them's apologizing to me. And I just looked and I was like, you know what? I mean, I frankly actually didn't even notice the dessert because it was one of those things like I looked at it, knew in my mind, like, you know, can't go there. And it just left my mind. And I was continuing on with the conversation and they're all feeling guilty and bad that I couldn't have it. And I'm thinking, I'm not even, it's as if there's not even a plate sitting on the table. It just doesn't even register with me because I know if I eat that, you know, not only am I going to feel bad, but then I know the antibodies are going to go up and it's this whole spiraling effect. So, you know, once you kind of know that information for most people, they kind of lose interest and it suddenly doesn't become quite as difficult. I don't know if you experienced the same on your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a complete mind shift. So I went to, you know, I used to bake and make a lot of desserts and things like that. And I really don't miss them. It's, people are so surprised to hear that, but you know, I love the way I eat now. I have my green smoothies and I have, you know, my pork things that I make and they're just really, really tasty.
Great. So what else did you kind of uncover as you were, you know, going through this besides, you know, that clearly gluten and dairy were big issues for you?
Oh my goodness. So I think the autoimmune conditions, I think it's kind of like an onion. You could just keep peeling back layers and layers and you find that you have all of these things going on and it seemed like it was never ending, but yeah, I definitely had adrenal fatigue. So I kind of mentioned that I was very skeptical of that because I just didn't think that really existed based on all of the, you know, if you have Addison's, you have Addison's. That's the only type of adrenal issue you can have. But you know, that's not really the case. And sure enough, I took the recommended supplements for adrenal fatigue and I got better. So my energy got so much better and I felt better. I didn't feel stressed out. I didn't have the weird salt cravings and all of those other crazy things that people get with adrenal fatigue.
Awesome. So right, and as we both know, you know, many people think that you know, your genetics is your destiny, that your mom, you know, your aunt has lupus, your grandmother had thyroid, your mom has thyroid, you know, you're destined to get thyroid. Or, you know, what I frequently hear here is like, of course I have thyroid, like everybody in my my family has thyroid. But tell us how that is not true.
So yeah, so the interesting thing about genetic conditions is if you have two identical twins, and if you have the same genes, obviously identical twins have the same genes. So that if one of them had a purely genetic condition, then the chances that the other one would have it would be like 100%, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the concordance rate is with people with autoimmune disease. It's somewhere, depending on the condition, I think it's somewhere between 50%. Is that right?
What I've read and what I've, you know, what I'm going on the research that I've looked at in writing my book is that it's about 30%. 70% is environment and 30% is genetics. Even some say 25% is genetics and 75% is environment. So that is enormous.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's huge. And I think that's something really, really important to consider. So you've got two people with identical genes. And if it was purely genetic, then they both should have the condition. So my mom is actually an identical twin and her twin sister had Graves and my mom never did. So you kind of look at, well, you look at the environmental triggers and you look at all of these other things that have to be in place for the condition to develop. So one of the things that really inspired me in my journey was the work of Dr. Alessio Fasano, and he was looking at developing a immunization for cholera, but instead he came across this amazing discovery that there are three things that need to be present for autoimmunity to develop, and that's the combination of the right genes, the right triggers, as well as the intestinal permeability. So I think that's really, really amazing that we look at the genes are really not your destiny. And I think we can really do a lot to impact our future and our health just by taking care of our environment.
Absolutely. And I definitely want to get into those environmental triggers. And actually, what we have now discovered is that there are people getting celiac who do not possess the celiac genes. So we now actually know that you don't even have to possess the genes in order to get a disease, which is even more fascinating than, you know, than, yeah. So we are now, you know, we've hybridized and, you know, changed the system so much and have so many toxins out there and all the things that go into this that, yes, now people are beginning to get diseases that they don't even have the genes for. It's pretty, pretty frightening.
Wow.
So let's talk about some of the environmental factors. You talk about infections and toxins, of course, leaky gut.
Yeah, so I have this approach, and I don't know how I woke up with one day with it, and I was like, you know, it feels like I just keep digging and digging, and somehow the letters ended up working out. And I have this little acronym called Dig At It. And so so nutrient depletions often will play a role in Hashimoto's. So deficiency in selenium has been particularly identified as something that can lead to the condition. Digestion is a really, really important factor. So a lot of times people with Hashimoto's and other autoimmune conditions will have low amounts of stomach acid. And this kind of sounds counterintuitive because, you know, I had acid reflux and you typically think of that as being excess acid. But as you know, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners know that a lot of times the symptoms of low stomach acid and high stomach acid are almost identical. They very much overlap. So a lot of times people are not digesting their proteins very, very well, and this can cause an immune system reaction. Let's see here. Infections, I think, are one of the most interesting and one of my most, you know, this is something that's very, very common and very underrated, I think, in people with autoimmune conditions. So,
yeah, so tell us about some of those, because I know you came in, you know, you didn't come in. My patient came in, you know, alerting me to this chapter about all these different infections. And there's certainly some that I absolutely knew were related to thyroid and some that I hadn't known the relation. So do you want to talk a little bit about those? What are different infections?
So Epstein-Barr virus, that's one particular infection that a lot of people with Hashimoto's, they'll have a history of having that particular infection. Another one is Yersinia. So that's a bacteria that can infect the gut, and that can be associated with Hashimoto's. So some people have been able to eliminate that bacteria through the use of antibiotics, and they were able to get rid of their thyroid antibodies. The other types of infections are actually parasites, which we don't like to think that we have them. But oftentimes you'll have people who have parasites that infect their gut. And the parasites actually cause the intestinal permeability. And this ends up being, this ends up causing a lot of the immune system reactions. And when you get rid of these parasites or infections, a lot of times people will greatly have improved symptoms and can even go into remission. H. pylori is one that is associated with ulcers. And recently that's been connected with thyroid antibodies. So I actually just had a reader write me a letter a couple of weeks ago, and it said, you know, I think you're onto something. I had H. pylori and I had Hashimoto's for 20 years. Just got this treated with my doctor, and my antibodies are now at 12, which, you know, is very, very low. So less than 35 is considered to be, I would consider to be in remission.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the big ones I would think to look at. And I would encourage everybody, you know, definitely to be tested for these type of infections. So I think anything that can really upset the balance in the gut can have that impact.
Yeah, so I mean, it's two-part. It's definitely certainly the parasites and the other bacterial infections that are disrupting the gut, creating the leaky gut, which, as Fusano says, seems to be one of the triggers that someone needs to have in order to get autoimmunity. With Epstein-Barr and some of the other infections, it's also molecular mimicry. I think you talk about that in your book as well. Do you talk about
Yeah, absolutely. So,
yes, you want to tell us what that is?
Yeah, so molecular mimicry is basically, it's basically one of the leading autoimmune theories. And what they talk about is how the immune system becomes confused. So essentially, the proteins on a particular virus may look similar to the proteins we have on our thyroid. So basically, the immune cells, they just kind of recognize little tiny snippets of, you know, of the protein structure, and then they'll see it again, and then they'll attack, the wrong thing because they think it's the virus or the bacteria or the infection. And so that's kind of one of the leading theories on how autoimmunity develops.
Absolutely. And then gluten also looks very similar to a lot of our tissues, especially the thyroid. So that's one of the thoughts Absolutely. About gluten as well. So it's really fascinating when you start, you know, getting into that, that our body's going to attack what it, you know, is supposed to attack. But because our tissues look similar to these infections or foods, that ends up attacking the wrong thing and our body gets really confused. So it's both, I think it's a little scary in a certain kind of way, right? So
it's very scary. And then there are also toxins. So there are also, you know, like triclosan, which is added into antibacterial soaps that seems to have some sort of cross-reactivity with the thyroid tissue. And it's just, there's a lot of different things that we unfortunately, you know, we have this, I think the last 100 years or so, we've been thinking about better living through chemistry. And we haven't really been respecting our biology. And we just have all these chemicals that are put into our environment. We're not really sure of their safety. So things like flame retardants and antibacterial soaps and all of these halogenated chemicals can actually cause some issues, and they've been implicated in increasing the rates of autoimmune thyroid disorders.
Yeah, so that's a great topic. So let's talk about that, you know, sort of iodine deficiency and the role of iodine along with, you know, the halides, the fluorides and chlorides and whatnot, bromides.
Yeah, so with iodine, it's a very, very controversial subject in the thyroid world. And I often get people asking me questions about it, but essentially, iodine is a nutrient with a narrow therapeutic index. So that means it's kind of like a Goldilocks nutrient, where yes, you do need enough of it to not have hypothyroidism, because if you don't have enough, you'll have low thyroid function. But if you have too much of it, then you end up having too many problems from that as well. So it seems to have a U-shaped distribution in terms of thyroid disorders, where low levels of it, you have low thyroid. If you have excessive levels of iodine, they've done studies to show that the rates of autoimmune thyroid disorders actually increase. So you have population studies in different countries before they added iodine to the salt supply. So basically what they would do is they would measure the rates of thyroid antibodies in school-aged children or adults, or, you know, a few different countries did the same study, and they would find that the rates would be, you know, about 5%. And then they would repeat the study later on and 10 years after the iodine was added. And then they found that the same target group would have rates that were double, triple, sometimes quadruple of the thyroid antibodies. And I think that's kind of scary, because here we're trying to make a public health effort to, you know, obviously lower the rates of iodine-induced hypothyroidism, and then we end up with Hashimoto's, which is the other kind of reason. Hashimoto's is actually the number one reason for underactive thyroid in countries that add iodine to their salt supply. So these are the United States, Canada, most of Europe, as well as Australia. So most of our westernized countries that have made these public efforts are actually, you know, they've made some things better and some things worse.
Right. But I wonder, you know, when I hear that, I think also industrialized, so more packaged foods, more mm-hmm. genetically modified foods, more gluten and, you know, sugar-filled foods, more toxins. So my thought is that is not necessarily a one-to-one correlation, but it more has to do with as everything that we're kind of talking about here.
Yeah, it's kind of a perfect storm scenario. And the other thing that's really important to consider is that, our thyroid does not live in a vacuum, and neither do these nutrients. So one nutrient is not responsible for everything. So for example, with iodine, a lot of times people will have selenium deficiency, and selenium actually, taking selenium can actually prevent some of the problems from the excess iodine. And a lot of times when we have gut issues or our soils are depleted of selenium, that we're not going to have enough of it. So it's kind of, it's a very delicate, intricate system that, you really can't explain just by one thing going on. So it's kind of a lot of events that line up to cause this perfect storm.
So, and I don't remember from your book, do you recommend people, eat iodine-rich foods like, nori and seaweed, and maybe even take a small iodine supplementation, or are you not recommend that, or what are your thoughts?
So I actually recommend that they get tested for iodine levels. So ZRT Labs does a test that you can do and to see where you're, if you have sufficient levels of iodine. And so if you're deficient, then it might be indicated to do some iodine. And if you have excess amounts of it, or if you're within range, then you probably would not need it. So for some people, I've seen some people who have gone on really, really high iodine protocols, where they would consult with me after, and then their TSH would skyrocket and their antibodies would skyrocket. So for people like that, I sometimes would actually recommend even a short-term restriction of iodine, less than, less than 150 micrograms a day.
And how's ZRT testing it?
They do a urinary spot analysis.
Yeah. So do they have you take you a big, it's just a spot. They don't have you take a big dose of iodine and see what your excretion is?
No, so they just look at your levels in real time without any kind of dosing or anything like that.
I'll have to check into that. I mean, the two labs or the two tests that I'm familiar with, there's a lot of debate about the accuracy. One is, to put the mercurochrome or the iodine on your skin and to see, how long it takes to absorb it. And, the more quickly it absorbs, then the more you need iodine. But the thought process is that everybody absorbs things at a different rate and, the skin and
your fat content and stuff like that. Yeah.
Right. And then the other one is a sort of almost like a challenge test where you do take a big dose of iodine and then you do a urinary excretion test and see how much iodine, again, you took up. And the thought process there, again, is that everybody, absorbs things at different rates. And so how do you really fully measure that? So it's kind of an interesting thought about the ZRT test. I hadn't known about that one.
Yeah, they did quite a bit of research on it and found it to be very, very helpful for a lot of people. So people with, it detects iodine deficiency as well as if you're within level. So I found that test to be very helpful and I was impressed with the research behind it.
Good. Yep. Always good. Like it when I learn something. So, so did we make it all the way through your dig at it approach? I think we kind of got off track a couple of times and I didn't want you to feel cut off with that.
Oh yeah. So yeah, we're just having so much fun chatting about all these cool things. So definitely after the D there come the infections and then gut and gluten. So gluten is a really, really big trigger for a lot of autoimmune conditions that we've talked about. And I hope that everybody with an autoimmune condition knows to get off of that. As well as adrenals. So looking at the adrenal function is really, really important. A lot of times people will have impaired adrenal function with Hashimoto's, and that can actually make us think that we're having thyroid symptoms when they're actually adrenal symptoms. Alkaline phosphatase is actually, it's something that helps us detoxify our gram-negative bacteria that we have in our gut. And so if we don't have enough of that, then we can develop reactions to our gut bacteria. So that's something else that is worth looking into. And that can be associated with a zinc deficiency and a couple of other deficiencies. Let's see here. There are a lot of different triggers that can can cause the condition. So sometimes it's hormonal issues that can trigger it. We know that people might be more likely to develop this Hashimoto's during usually puberty, pregnancy, and perimenopause are seem to be some of the peak times. Food intolerances are a really big deal, and not just gluten. So sometimes people might have multiple food sensitivities to gluten, dairy, soy, or corn, or grains, and you just get, you know, a lot of different foods that you might react to, as well as the toxins. So those are kind of the main things that I think are a really good starting point for everybody to look at and make sure that you fully rule those things out so that you know what's causing an imbalance in your system.
And so along those lines, sounds like you do some consultations. And so how do you, or through your book, have people approach this mess? They've just gotten diagnosed with Hashimoto's. You know, where do they start?
Yeah, it kind of seems very overwhelming because it's just, you really, you know, it's a lifestyle change and you're just not used to thinking that way and changing so many different things. So the first thing that I would have people do is really to look at their diet and try to focus on more of a nutrient-dense diet. So multiple dietary approaches have been reported to be helpful, including like a gluten-free, dairy-free diet that we talked about, specific carbohydrate diet, the GAPS diet, the body ecology diet, paleo diet, and autoimmune paleo diet. So those are some of the most helpful diets.
And of course, the Myers way. Just kidding. Not kidding, but yes.
We will add that on there.
So. Yeah.
And so basically what all of these diets have in common is that they leave out processed foods, they leave out sugar, they leave out all the, white things like the flours. They're all nutritionally dense, and they leave out the reactive foods. So that's something really important to think about is, you know, let's figure out step one, let's figure out what's going on with this person's diet. So are they eating the right foods? Are they nutrient deficient because they're not eating the right foods? And are they reacting to gluten or dairy or some of these other proteins? So I think that would be a really, really important step. Obviously after the diagnosis, because that is something that you need for sure. And then after you do that with the diet, you also want to make sure that you stabilize the blood sugar. So looking at eating enough protein with every meal and enough fat with every meal, and trying to not eat so many starchy foods and foods high in sugar to help stabilize the blood sugar. The other thing we look at is nutrient deficiencies. So a lot of times people will have deficiency in stomach acid, deficiency in B12, ferritin, vitamin D, and selenium, and you want to address those things. And then we look at looking at adrenal testing. So like an adrenal saliva test has been very, very helpful in determining if people have some adrenal fatigue and what can be done about that. And the next step would be looking at the gut. So doing some comprehensive gut profile testing to see if there's an imbalance of good versus bad bacteria, or if there's a lingering infection, or if there's some sort of an enzyme deficiency that can be making you more reactive to the proteins.
So that all sounds great. I feel slightly different than you do about the order of some of those things. I kind of feel like if somebody's in my office with thyroid issues, I mean, it's your whole hormonal axis that you likely have adrenal issues. And I typically don't test for adrenal issues. I just support the adrenals and try to figure out the stressors, these which are the same things mm-hmm. that have likely caused the autoimmune. And definitely put the gut a little bit sooner because the gut is the gateway to health. So, but yes, absolutely. Totally agree with that approach of addressing all of those things. And it's just once you get into it, you realize how they all so go together, right? I mean, the nutrient deficiencies came from the leaky gut, that came from the food sensitivity that you had in the first place to the gluten, and and then eating too much sugar led to the small bowel bacterial overgrowth, but then depleted your vitamin B12, which then you needed for your thyroid. And it's kind of like my head starts swarming about all the interconnections, about how it all is, you know, related, and that it is not, you know, just like no body part is in a vacuum. None of these issues Absolutely. Is really in a vacuum.
So you just kind of assume at this point that everybody's just going to have adrenal issues, huh?
Yeah, so it's sort of like the gluten spectrum. There is a spectrum of adrenal fatigue. There's no problem with your adrenals, which I mean, maybe the Dalai Lama is in that category. I don't know, but you know, he's human and he has stressors as well. So, but maybe he can meditate them away and stay calm.
Maybe the Buddha.
Yeah, right. I mean, you know, there's somebody out there who's, you know, living in an ashram in India, meditating all day, who does not have adrenal fatigue. But probably most all of you all listening to this podcast have some level of it. I mean, you know, I practice what I preach, and I know I have it still. So it is dramatically improved, but you know, I'm just a type A personality. So, and then there's, as you mentioned, the autoimmune spectrum of it, which is the Addison's. And then pretty much everybody falls somewhere in between there. You could be, you know, one step away from having no problem or one step towards Addison's and basically need steroids. In my clinic, I don't use steroids for people. So it's just not something I believe, you know, I mean, I believe you got to solve the problem. Are there people that are so sick that probably need steroids to, you know, get them up out of bed? Yes. But, you know, I still really don't write for steroids. I just don't want to go down that road. So pretty much you're somewhere on that spectrum. And so my goal is yours is to find that root cause of why is their adrenal stressed anyway. They're in a bad marriage. They're living in a house full of mold. They're eating gluten. They have, you know, candida. You know, whatever it is, and you support the adrenal glands while you're looking for that cause of the adrenal fatigue. And, you know, while you're looking for that, you're also probably uncovering the same reasons that the person got the thyroid disease in the first place. So you're kind of killing a couple birds, you know, with one stone and supporting the adrenal glands. And of course, you know, doing whatever practice works for you to help relieve stress, whether that's going for a run or meditating or, you know, using some sort of app to track your breathing or yoga or acupuncture. I mean, you know, different things work differently for different people in terms of, you know, reducing a hot bath, a massage, you know, whatever it is, taking a walk with your dog or playing with your children. I mean, there are many ways to relieve stress. So you just got to figure out what's the one that does that for you, or several that do that for you?
Yeah, I fully agree with you. And I think everybody is going to have, you know, some combination of a food sensitivity. Somebody's going to have some level of adrenal fatigue, as well as a gut issue. So those are some, and nutrient deficiency. So those are things that I think are going to be present in just about everybody.
I completely agree.
If we could do them all at once, that would be awesome. So I love that you approach it all
I definitely
at once.
Try to. I mean, by the time somebody's come to see me, they're at their wit's end. You know, I don't see, you know, a lot of patients. So, you know, so it can be expensive. And so people want to, you know, and they're at the end of the rope. They've already been to 10 other people and somebody hasn't helped them. So they're ready to just, you know, dive in. But if they're not ready to dive in, you know, we do go in a stepwise approach and we go slow. And, you know, I'm obviously there to help them get well at whatever. As I tell them, it's not a race. You know, I imagine they want to get as well as quickly as possible, as I want them to as well, but it's not a race. So, whatever we need to do to make that happen, you know, just emotionally, as you mentioned, you know, this can be difficult. It's a lot of changes. You know, physically, it can be sometimes challenging, changing the diet, swallowing a bunch of pills in the beginning. You know, financially, it can be difficult running all these tests, buying supplements, you know, all that kind of stuff. So you got to go at, you know, at the pace that you can, you know, mentally, physically, and financially afford to go at. And I'm lucky that typically by the time people get to me, they're ready to just, you know, dive in. And so, you know, because of that, and, you know, I have a really successful practice because people are, you know, at the point where they're ready to do whatever it is to get well. And when you are willing to do that, as I know you know personally and through the people you've counseled and probably the emails and letters you've gotten about your book, they can get well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you mentioned something that's really, really important, and it's the drive from within, from that person to get well, that I think really, really matters. Because, you know, you as a doctor, you could tell them everything that they need to do, but it really takes them doing it and being on board with the whole, with the whole protocol. So I love that, you know, that you're available. And we often get questions about which doctors to recommend. So I would love to have them. Hopefully your waiting list is not too long. So I would love to have them be able to come and see you.
Absolutely. I'm always happy to see patients. And the other thing, just sort of touching on that point, is that the mind is a powerful thing. So far more powerful than many people give it credit for. So, you know, at the end of the day, yes, your attitude about all this is going to play a massive, massive role, not only in motivation, but just your outlook of, you know, do you at your core believe that you can get well? And do you believe that there's someone out there that can help you get well? Because if you don't believe that, you're probably not going to get well. But if you genuinely believe that and you're like up for the I'm going to get well, then, you know, you'll get well.
Yeah, I agree. So having a positive attitude always helps with everything.
Well, let's talk about something that I know people are going to be really fascinated about, not only your personal experience, but that of a pharmacist, about the various thyroid medications. So, you know, there's Synthroid and then generic Synthroid, and then there's Armor and Naturethroid and T3 and Cytomel and compounded, blah. I mean, so is there, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, there are a lot of different choices for medications, and you know, and I've had people who have said, you know, I want to do this medication free and I don't want to get on medications. And sometimes, you know, we do need to be on medications, in my opinion, just to help to get the levels of thyroid hormone back into the body, because thyroid hormone deficiency is, you know, can be quite dramatic and can interfere with the healing process. So one of the drug of choice is actually levothyroxine, which is the generic name, and the brand name for that is Synthroid. And a lot of times people, you know, there are people that do quite well on it, but unfortunately a lot of people do not do very well on it. And they might react to some of the fillers in the medication, or they may not be able to convert it properly. So levothyroxine is known as T4, and that's one of the main thyroid hormones, but it's the less active thyroid hormone. So T3 is actually the more active hormone, and the T4 needs to be converted into T3 to really have the really, you know, the main physiologic effects on the body. So I think of T3 as our pretty hair hormone and, you know, energy hair hormone and keeping us warm hormone. And that, for some reason, and, you know, there are different nutrient deficiencies and adrenal dysfunction and stress and starvation and whole list of things that can impair the conversion from T4 to T3. And some people just, you know, they'll be on the Synthroid or levothyroxine and they just don't feel that well. And so a lot of times people will benefit from a medication that has a combination of T4 and T3. And that might be adding a medication like Cytomel, which only has the T3, or it might be doing something like Armor or Naturethroid. And in some cases, some people do better on compounded thyroid medications. The compounded medications can be made free of fillers, and they can be made, they are usually more of the synthetic base, so they're not going to have the other type of things that the natural medications might have. So just to back up a little bit, some patients, and this is not across the board, but some people may actually have immune reactions to the thyroid medications, and this is more rare than common. And so for those patients, doing something like a compounded medication may be more indicated, or for patients that really can't tolerate a lot of fillers. Another interesting thing is that some people with that can't tolerate lactose may have difficulty absorbing their thyroid medications, and they can have lactose in them. Let's see here. The other main thing about medications is that people are often not dosed correctly with them. So I always want to stress, you know, doing the lab testing would be TSH, free T4, and then free T3 as a minimum for patients, because if you just look at the one TSH number, that doesn't always tell you the full story, as well as looking at the more of the functional ranges of the TSH. So back in the day when they developed the ranges for TSH, I know that they took some elderly people and people with impaired thyroid function into the mix, and then you ended up with this really, really lax range, where, an average person would not, a person with normal thyroid function would not have a TSH above 2.5, but they were considering a TSH as high as 8 to be normal. So I'll tell you, my TSH when it was 4.5, I was lethargic. I was a sloth. And, when it was around a 3, I can't brush my hair. So my hair starts getting really, really tangled. So for most people, they seem to feel best between 0.5 and 2 with that TSH range. And some docs I know will say, I don't know what your opinion on this is, but they'll say somewhere around 1 should be a goal TSH for a lot of people.
Yeah, between 1 and 2, or I say lower, if you're actually on Armour or some sort of T3, then it can artificially suppress your TSH and you really can't track it. So many of my patients are actually, below 1.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it really is looking at the patient, not just the lab values, which, everybody, I think, learns about, but then you don't see some of the... So, you hear from patients that just aren't doing well and their doctors don't seem to be following that.
Yeah, I had a patient yesterday, actually, in fact, and she was saying, we upped her thyroid medicine. She said, I get this, forgotten what it was, but some feeling, that she craved salt when her thyroid was off. And I was like, well, your thyroid levels actually look amazing. They're much better than before. And, things are looking better, not worse for you. She's like, well, that's so weird, and this is how I always feel. And I said, well, why don't we just stick with, what do you want to do? Do you want to go back down? Do you want to stay at the same dose? She's like, no, let's stay at the same dose. And I said, well, let's, check it in another month and see what happens. But, at the end of the day, if you know that that's what your body's doing and you feel like something's off or worse, like, I want to listen to you, not that your labs got better, And she so appreciated it, but it's so true. I mean, a lot of times, I'm sure as pharmacists and physicians, you're like, okay, this is what you look at. These are the numbers. This is the range. This is what it needs to be. And, you're forgetting that there's a human in front of you that knows, their body better than, any lab test and better than anyone else.
Yeah, that's so important. And I'm really glad that you said that.
So, do you often see, I definitely get some patients saying, the little bit of cornstarch or, corn filler and this medicine or that medicine, I think is causing problems for me. Is that something that you as a pharmacist, did you have a lot of people coming back with that or feeling that way?
Yeah, I do get that a lot. So some people are really, really sensitive to corn and they may react to the little bit of cornstarch. Some people might be really sensitive to lactose, and most of the thyroid medications are actually gluten-free, but Synthroid is not guaranteed to be gluten-free, so there might be maybe some cross-contamination issues. So the tiny amounts do matter, and they can really impact the absorption. So there are different fillers in the compound in meds as well can really impact somebody's absorption rate. So I had somebody that switched to a compounded medication and her TSH, same dose as of, I think she was reacting to the Armour. And so she went on a same dose of compounded medication and her TSH jumped to like a 50 within 3 to 4 weeks. So one thing that I always recommend for people, if they're going to be switching medications, is to really, really watch out for those little subtle signs. And you know yourself best. For me, it was always, okay, I can't brush my hair and I'm putting on a sweatshirt. And my husband is from Texas, so he always likes the house a little bit cooler than I do. I grew up in the Midwest. And so there's always, when I'm looking at my husband and saying, did you turn the air down again? And it's 70 degrees and I'm putting on 3 sweatshirts. That would always be a sign for me that something was off. So just really knowing yourself and being careful when you switch medications, because the fillers can really make a difference.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Well, good. Well, this has been so helpful and informative. I know that I've certainly enjoyed the podcast. I hope all the listeners have out there. How can people get a hold of you if they want to, follow you or possibly make a consultation with you? And then where can they get your book?
So I have a website. It's called thyroidpharmacist.com. And I actually have some great information in there about how to get started on a gluten-free diet, and gives you my free chapter of the nutrient depletions and digestion chapter, as well as 10 recipes. And that's thyroidpharmacist.com/gift. So you could get that information on there. And I also have a Facebook page called Thyroid Lifestyle that you could follow on Facebook. And I do give lots of daily tips and things on how to improve your thyroid health. And I actually just wanted to mention, I actually am looking for practitioners that I could refer people to, because I don't provide a lot of consultations, unfortunately.
Okay.
So So I'm really, really excited that I found another one that I can refer people to.
Absolutely. Always happy to see patients and help out. And your book really seems like a great resource and a great place for people to start. So I hope everybody can check it out. It's really filled with some great information and checklists, and you know, what are the right thyroid labs to order, and what are the levels you should have. And again, you can take this book in, just like one of my patients did, and you know, say, hey, what about this infection? And ask even, you know, your family physician. You don't always need a functional medicine physician. I mean, yes, a lot of this stuff you can kind of do on your own, you know, by following websites like mine or Isabella's, and you know, getting this information, how-to guides, reading these books. You know, we now have the e-courses for gluten and my program, The Myers Way, that has the autoimmune in it. So you can follow these things. And then obviously you do need a physician if you are on medications to run these tests for you and to, you know, possibly tweak your medications. You know, most of the time when somebody comes into me who's been on thyroid medication and we're checking it, they are not on the right dose. So really, you know, check out Isabella's book, look at what, you know, the level should be, read about your different types of thyroid options for medicines, and, you know, do your best. I know sometimes the conventional doctors are stuck in their heads and they don't want to, you know, their ego is in the way and don't want to be told what to do. But, you know, often if you can approach it in a way like, hey, do you think maybe we could just give this a try and see how I feel? Or if not, try to find somebody else. There are open-minded, you know, physicians that don't practice functional medicine that, you know, are always an option. And then, you know, using a book like this or the resources that Isabella has or I have, or, you know, that you may know of other places to go gluten-free, heal your gut, and, you know, and get on some good quality supplements to get over those nutrient deficiencies. So, yeah. Well, I really appreciate you being on the call. It was an awesome call. And like I said, I know this is really helpful for a lot of people, and check out her book. All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Isabella. It was great speaking with you.
Thank you so much, Amy. It was all my pleasure.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramymyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at Amy Myers, MD.